Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Iowa PBS. For more than 45 years, Market to Market has provided perspective on the commodities, from farm gate to dinner plate. Find three new agribusiness podcasts each week, the M2M Podcast, Market Analysis, and Market Plus, all available wherever you subscribe and listen to podcasts.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in this half hour, we'll find out about the Humane Society's ranking of Iowa as one continuing to be one of the worst when it comes to inhumane dog breeders. But first, let's go to Kathy Obradovich, editor-in-chief of the Iowa Capital Dispatch. Hi, Kathy.
Hey, Ben. Thanks for having me today.
Well, thanks for checking back in with us. It's been a couple weeks, I think, since our lawmakers' per diem daily pay stopped. They're still at work. What's holding them up?
Well, lawmakers were joking a couple of weeks ago, Ben, that there were only two things holding up adjournment: the budget and taxes. And that really describes the situation in Iowa pretty well. There's clearly a lot more than two things involved in those two categories here. But ultimately, when you look at the issues that they really have to decide before they adjourn, what it comes down to is budget and tax issues. There are big differences still between the House and Senate on a variety of things related to the budget. One of them is how to pay for mental health. The Senate and the governor want to end a $100 million property tax levy for mental health, which has been in place for a long time. It generates most of the money that goes to providing the services, although Medicaid is also involved in paying providers. The Senate, sees a win-win here. It's a big property tax cut that particularly rural folks, the Farm Bureau, farmers, love that. Plus, the property tax is really politically unpopular across the board. Mm-hmm. It would partially at least solve the problem of not having a sustainable source of money for the enhancements that the legislature has proposed for mental health and put into law over the past couple of years. So the problem there is that the House has reservations about the state taking over such a huge obligation. Again, we're talking about, they're probably not going to pay out $100 million a year, but the Senate's initial plan was $60 million. Mm-hmm. So the state would be taking over a huge obligation without having more control over how mental health services are delivered. That's still operated by regional organizations that are made up of counties. And so the House wants more thought into how all of that would work. There's a bunch of other tax policy issues. The Senate has like a 100-page bill, something like that. The House has some things they want that are a little bit more discreet than that. Plus, they don't even agree on a lot of budget issues.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And also a child care policy. What's happening there? Is that part of the holdup as well?
It definitely is. The House in particular has been pretty aggressive on child care policy. They passed more than a dozen bills earlier in the session. Only one or two of those has actually made it to the governor. One in particular that the House wants would eliminate what they call the child care cliff effect. And what that means is what people experience if they qualify for child care assistance, which is really important, but they get a very slight raise, a minor increase in their salary, and all of a sudden that child care money is cut off abruptly, and child care ends up costing them more than the raise that they would have received, and they end up turning down those raises. It just holds them back in their careers. And so the House wanted to sort of phase out that child care assistance instead of having it end abruptly. It's really important to members of the House. The House Speaker has said a couple of times that they think this is a condition of adjournment. So far, the Senate has not accepted all those child care bills that the House wants.
Mm-hmm. A lot of other facets there to be loose ends to be tied up there. In a few words, Kathy, What's your prediction on when this session will end?
Well, it'll be at least another week and maybe two more weeks. It really depends on when they come together on some of these agreements. And they're difficult ones. I mean, the House didn't want to spend any extra money for state universities. The Senate has a little bit of money. I mean, there's issues about how much money to spend on prisons. So, and there's also some social conservative issues in there as well. The governor said this last minute she wanted something dealing with transgender student participation in sports. That's a controversial bill. And you've got factions within the Republican Party who really want that. So it is going to be a matter of everybody trying to appease the people they have to appease and roll over the ones that need to be rolled over in order to get everything done.
Mm-hmm. In the last couple of minutes, I'd like to pivot to Iowa's congressional delegation. And, of course, this week, Wednesday, the House of Representatives, the Republicans, ejected one of their most conservative members, Liz Cheney, from their leadership ranks as punishment for repudiating former President Trump's false claims of a stolen election. Cheney remaining defiant. She says she plans to seek re-election to Congress. I wonder, how has Iowa's mostly Republican congressional delegation reacted to that?
Most of them have reacted with silence, I'll have to say.
And, silence.
this was a closed-door vote. So we don't, you know, they didn't have to tell us how they voted. The one person who was public with her position was Representative Ashley Hinson. She publicly said she was supporting the New York representative who took Cheney's place, Elise Stefanik, or at least supporting her to take the place of the conference chair position that Cheney held. Now, Stefanik did help Hinson with her campaign when she was running for election, but also Hinson has been publicly named as a possible choice for that leadership spot, which may explain why she went public mm-hmm. and supporting somebody else. Senator Joni Ernst was the only other Republican in the Iowa delegation who spoke out publicly to defend Cheney. She was quoted in media reports saying Cheney should be able to speak her mind, and Ernst referred to Cheney's removal from leadership as an example of cancel culture. You know, that's kind of an interesting position from Joni Ernst, who is widely considered to be, you know, kind of four square behind Trump. Yeah. But Ernst actually did, you know, she was generally supportive of Trump, but she did criticize his conduct related to the Capitol riots on January 6th. So it's possible that there was some empathy there for Cheney. And Senator Chuck Grassley was asked about it. He basically said it's none of the Senate's business how the yeah. House conducts itself.
And quickly, before we go, Kathy, how do Republicans answer the charge made by Cheney and some other Republicans that not calling out Donald Trump on his repeated claims of election fraud, that the 2020 election was not free and fair? We know it was, in fact, that they're placing self-interested power above country, that they are helping Donald Trump undermine our democratic system. What is the response you get there?
Yeah, there's a couple of ways that Republicans answer this, and one is just to sort of dodge the issue and talk about it not being this not being about Donald Trump, that this is about unity, and that that Cheney was, you know, not marching with everybody else, and that, you know, it was disruptive in the caucus, and you're sort of making it about something else besides Donald Trump and what he said after the election. I think that the other part that we've seen is that Republicans, even those who have admitted that Biden won the election, are now sort of doubling down on the idea that, you know, Donald Trump had every right to question, and that he, he may be, you know, as you look at things like the audit in Arizona, for example, that, you know, that we still don't know, they might say, we still don't know for sure, you know, everything about how that election was conducted. So I think that there's not a lot of direct response to the idea that Cheney was ousted because she called out Donald Trump for lying about the election.
Yeah. It's clear Republicans just want this to fade away as quickly as possible. We'll see if that happens.
My guess is it won't be happening anytime soon.
Okay. Kathy Obradovich, editor-in-chief of the Iowa Capital Dispatch. Thanks for joining us today, Kathy. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Ben. You too.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, this week, the Humane Society of the United States ranked Iowa as the state with the third highest number of puppy mills. It noted 11 locations that are in, its words, filthy, hazardous condition. Now, Monday's release of the Society's annual Horrible 100 report lists dog breeders, it says, fail to provide adequate care to dogs and puppies. And this is based on state and federal inspections, complaints from the public, and undercover investigations. Missouri had the largest number of businesses on this Horrible 100 list, 21, followed by Ohio, 16. And as I mentioned, Iowa, number third spot, undesirable spot at 11 locations. Sybil Sukup is joining me, Executive Director of the Humane Society of Northern Iowa. Hi, Sybil.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Good afternoon. Tell us, remind us, what is a puppy mill? How do you define that? And what do they look like typically when you go inside?
Well, there's no real definition of a puppy mill because it can be, you know, nobody in the industry wants to be labeled as a puppy mill. But people in my industry, in the welfare industry, we have a pretty clear definition of a puppy mill. And for us, it's any dog breeder that puts wealth over welfare, meaning that they put their own profiting over the care of the animals that they are breeding. So that can be a breeder that has, you know, 5 dogs, 50 dogs, or 500 dogs. The level of care they provide is, if it's compromised, to me, that's considered a puppy mill. What do they look like? You know, from the road, they look like any other farm. And that's why when you list off those states like Missouri, Ohio, Iowa, it's because we have a lot of farm properties available in these Midwestern states that breeders can convert old buildings, dairy barns, you know, hog buildings. They can convert those into dog breeding facilities quite easily. And from the road, you would never guess that there's dozens or even hundreds of dogs living a life of confinement within these facilities.
I wonder if you can point and even name some of the locations that are named in this latest Humane Society of Iowa report. Where are they found? What can you tell us specifically about any of these locations?
Well, fortunately for my area, there are none on the Horrible 100 list this year that are directly in my area. So some of these communities are in southwestern, southeastern, eastern Iowa, like Chiron was listed, Toronto, Iowa, Melvin, Iowa. These are communities that I haven't spent time there, and I haven't been to these particular facilities. But reading through the reports, what I read are conditions that I have seen in facilities that I have been in. Overcrowding, animals lacking veterinarian care. You know, it's perfectly common to walk into a barn and find 100 dogs living in elevated wire-floored cages that haven't had any human contact, you know, that are living this way for years and years and years, for the entirety of their lives, until they're no longer productive.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, I mean, it's heartbreaking to hear these stories and imagine these inhumane conditions, but past that, there's a real problem with acquiring a pet that's been raised in such a inhumane state. Describe what that would be.
So, you know, a lot of my role as the director of my shelter is to place animals into homes through adoption. And so that's my core work here at the shelter. But being an advocate for animals in any situation is really my overall mission in life. And so puppy mills has become, excuse the pun, a pet project for me. Educating the public, though, is a really important step because a lot of people, they still are not aware of what puppy mills are. And then when you get out to larger cities or away from Iowa in the Midwest, you know, people go online and they order a puppy from these puppy mills that are located here in Iowa and sight unseen without knowing what kind of situation they're coming from without seeing the parent dogs. And then a puppy can just be shipped to these people from, you know, who knows where they're at. Like it's just another Amazon delivery or something, you know? Mm-hmm. So people need to be educated when they're considering adding a furry friend to their family and do the research. There are good breeders out there. Not every dog breeder is a puppy mill in these heinous conditions. But good breeders care about their animals and they care where their puppies are going. And they want to interview potential homes just like a shelter does. So there are options available to people that are looking to add a furry friend. But, you know, there are a lot of red flags that a person should look for when they're doing so.
Okay. And I know in our pandemic, a lot of people have sought pets out for comfort in the isolation of their homes. So we don't have time to go into that. But right now, give us the resources. Someone listening who is considering getting a pet, an animal companion, a dog, a puppy, what are the best resources to seek out so that you don't buy from one of these breeders?
Sure. Well, there are some that are really on the surface that any consumer looking should be able to tell and kind of reveal themselves. And one is if you're looking on a breeder's website and they've got 15 different breeds available, you know, Schnauzer Doodle, Palmer Doodle, and any kind of doodle, and all these mixes, that means that they have to have quite a few breeding dogs around to be able to produce so many different mixed of breeds. That is a red flag, because I always ask people when they call and say, you know, how many dogs does this breeding facility have? I say, well, what do you think is a reasonable number for someone to be able to take care of? And they say, well, I don't know, maybe 5 or 10 dogs. Well, a lot of these places might have 100, 200, 300. Oh. That's a lot of dogs for any one person to take care of.
Wow.
So looking at the number of breeds listed that a breeder lists or offers is one red flag. Two is, and I know this is more difficult for somebody that's from, you know, hunt thousands of miles away that's looking to have a dog shipped to them. But, you know, I always tell people, show me the mama. That's something that a lot of welfare groups kind of say as their term. Show me the mama. That a person should ask to see the mother and the father of the dog, of the puppy, that they'd like to purchase. A good breeder will say, absolutely, come in and meet the parents. This will give you an idea of what kind of puppy your dog will, or dog your puppy will grow into be. If a breeder says, nope, you're not allowed on my property, I can't let you in the buildings, that also is a red flag. If you want to dig a little deeper, though, I always tell people to call their local humane society, like mine, or their veterinarian, or welfare organizations in their area, and ask for their input, because a lot of times they have resources to look up things like USDA inspection reports that would show you any violations that that particular breeder had and the number of dogs that were on their property during their last inspection. This information is available to the public, but it's very difficult and cumbersome to find through the USDA's website and to be able to do the search engine. So having someone help kind of help you out and guide you in that process is always helpful, and a lot of shelter people know how to do that kind of stuff.
Okay. Get in touch with your local animal shelter or humane society. Look that up on the web. Sybil Sukup, we've run out of time. Executive Director of the Humane Society of Northern Iowa. Thank you for giving us some tips on how we can reduce the number of inhumane dog breeders in Iowa and across the country. Sybil, thanks so much.
Thanks for discussing such an important topic.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The big COVID news this week, of course. The CDC now says it's safe for fully vaccinated people to take their masks off in most indoor settings. Now, states, cities, businesses, you and me are sorting through what to do with this new guidance. Natalie Krebs is here to help us in that endeavor, our health reporter here at Iowa Public Radio. Hi, Natalie.
Hey, Ben.
It's been more than a year since the CDC told us to mask up when in public, and now this news comes amid a sharp decline in coronavirus cases in the country, also an expansion of vaccine eligibility to everyone 12 and older. Break it down a little bit for us. What does this new guidance really mean?
Yeah, so according to the CDC, you can resume activities without wearing a mask or staying 6 feet apart if you've been fully vaccinated. Once again, fully vaccinated defined as 2 weeks after you got your final dose. So the second shot of the Pfizer, Moderna, or the first shot or that one dose Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So you can pretty much do most things, you know, kind of pre-pandemic now without having to do that social distancing or wear a mask. I mean, there are a couple situations where you're still supposed to be wearing a mask. That's with traveling on an airplane and such. But this is it's a really, really drastic change for the CDC.
Right. And if you don't feel comfortable taking your mask off yet, and you should by all means keep it on in these public situations. What does it mean for local mask mandates for stores, restaurants? What kind of change are we looking at there?
Well, you know, private businesses are still allowed to set the rules they want, so they can still ask you or require you to wear a mask if you're going in the building. I think a lot of businesses still are doing this for the time being. As far as mask mandates, you know, we've seen around the country a number of governors where mask mandates are still in effect, including our neighbor to the north, Minnesota, are considering, you know, relaxing them or getting rid of them even earlier because of the CDC guidance. And then even in Des Moines, you know, there's a mask mandate there. And, you know, the mayor county sent out a notice yesterday basically saying he's relooking at that policy now with this new guidance.
Right. And of course, the question is, if I am fully vaccinated, I know you are, Natalie, but, you know, we go into a restaurant, a cafe, or a shopping center, we don't know whether the stranger next to us, eating next to you, perhaps is vaccinated without a mask on. This is the honor system.
It is the honor system, yeah. And basically, I mean, what the CDC is saying is they found on evidence so far that if you are fully vaccinated, you're pretty protected from the virus. So if we're looking at people who aren't vaccinated yet or fully vaccinated yet are the ones sort of taking a risk. If they are going out without a mask, they're susceptible to getting COVID-19.
Okay. And a quick word, 12 and older, an expansion of vaccine eligibility to everyone 12 and older. Great news, right?
That's, yeah, great news as well. Yeah, Pfizer got that authorization this week. So now kids 12 years and older will now get the vaccine. And I believe in Iowa, they estimate there's about 167,000 Iowans are 12 to 15 years old. So that's another big group that's now eligible to be vaccinated.
Right. And plenty of doses here in Iowa. In fact, Iowa now for several weeks turning down available doses we couldn't use. So time to get vaccinated, everyone. We've said it many times, but we're coming out of this pandemic. We're so glad that we are, but we need more people vaccinated. Natalie Krebs, IPR health reporter, thank you so much.
Thank you, Ben.
Coming up after a short break, I'll be joined by IPR's Kate Payne. She'll talk about how the word abolish became hotly debated this week in the Iowa City Council. Also, I'll talk with physicists at the University of Iowa. They'll describe a new type of aurora phenomenon when we come back. They just spotted it, never before recorded. It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River. Back in just a moment. I'm Ben Kiefer.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Iowa PBS. For more than 45 years, Market to Market has provided perspective on the commodities, from farm gate to dinner plate. Find three new agribusiness podcasts each week, the M2M Podcast, Market Analysis, and Market Plus, all available wherever you subscribe and listen to podcasts.
And we're back with this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in just a few minutes, we gaze toward the heavens. I talk with two physicists at the University of Iowa who have found a new type of aurora behavior. But before that, back here on Earth, we check in with IPR's Kate Payne about what she's been covering this week. Kate, welcome back to the program.
Hi.
So let's talk about one word, and you could tell us the story this week behind the word that has stirred controversy in the Iowa City Council this week, abolish. What happened?
That's right. So it's all sort of started last Sunday. Iowa City City Council member Laura Burgess penned an opinion piece in the Cedar Rapids Gazette saying it's time to talk about police abolition. And Burgess is one of the newer members of the council, and she's really been leading the way on sort of translating demands of racial justice activists into policy proposals. And she basically said in this piece that modern policing is premised on force and violence, that people of color disproportionately bear the brunt of the negative consequences, sometimes deadly consequences of this. And she said that it's a system that can't be undone, even by good and passionate police officers, and that the city should really think about abolition.
Okay. And so the city council meeting rolls around midweek. And we have to say, of course, for those who don't know, Iowa City's city council, probably one of the most liberal in the state as far as city governments. Explain what happened.
Yeah. So Burgess knew that the council was going to have this discussion about a slate of recommendations that city staff had developed for restructuring the police, is how they've presented this. And this plan includes a number of things, some of which the city is already working on, already doing. And that includes things like crisis intervention training, also some policy changes like police not pulling over drivers for what they call secondary traffic violations, like a cracked windshield or taillight. And these plans also included jointly funding a number of positions with local service providers that would work with people experiencing homelessness or immigrant and refugee communities or people who need mental health support. But certainly these recommendations did not include abolition. And that was what Burgess wanted to put on the table as, you know, for her goal, her guiding question, she said, is how does the city move away from an armed response to emergency situations? And so she posed this in the meeting. None of her colleagues backed her up. The majority of the members made clear that they're opposed to police abolition. Mayor Bruce Teague was quite adamant that he thought even the phrase police abolition is dangerous politically. But we should say there was an acknowledgement, a sort of shared interest from council members in reimagining the role of police and in trying to elevate these other trained, unarmed professionals to respond or maybe co-respond. But they certainly don't want to call that abolition, and they don't see abolition as their goal.
Mm-hmm. And we should throw in here Mayor Bruce Teague of Iowa City, an African-American, using that phrase to describe abolition as politically dangerous. For those who might not know, why would it be politically dangerous in the mayor's view?
Well, I think across the country, we've seen some of these political fights play out as far as the politicization of police use of force, of police violence. Certainly across the country, we've seen again and again use of force that results in people of color in particular losing their lives at the hands of police. And we know it's attracted an incredible amount of attention, especially in the past year since the killing of George Floyd. And we're seeing advocates across the country really pushing to rethink the role of police and saying that this is unjust, this is wrong, and that there must be drastic change.
And how is this Iowa City Council debate seen, or what can you judge about how it is in the context of Iowa, other municipalities in Iowa? Is this an outlier? Is this something that perhaps is also up for discussion in other city councils or not?
Certainly other city councils are taking reviews of their own police forces as well. We've seen developments of community police review boards, allowing citizens to have a more direct way to pose complaints of police actions and have those reviewed by city officials. But I think, you know, as you mentioned before, Johnson County, Iowa City is sort of justifiably viewed as one of the more progressive more left-leaning local governments in the state. And so for people who are looking for some of these more drastic reforms of truly moving away from modern policing, envisioning a totally different sort of public safety response, it seems that they're not going to get the most drastic response from the Iowa City Council at this point.
We have a minute or so left. Kate, I wanted to ask you about another thing you've been reporting on this week, namely that activists in the Des Moines area calling on state leaders to improve conditions in Iowa prisons. And you've done so much outstanding reporting on Iowa prisons. Tell us quickly about that.
Yes. So the Des Moines Black Liberation Movement and the Central Iowa Democratic Socialists of America have been calling attention to conditions in the prisons for months, and they've been corresponding with incarcerated people and then bringing forth what they've learned and raising attention to that. And so some of the things on their mind certainly are some of the restrictions that we've seen after the deadly attack on two staffers at the Anamosa prison earlier this spring. We've seen work responsibilities cut back significantly, lockdowns for incarcerated people as the state continues its investigation. And these advocates are really saying, you know, this is wearing on people, that mental health, emotional health is a concern as these restrictions wear on and as inmates have gone more than a year without seeing their loved ones because of COVID-19.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you for keeping us up to date on that and these other stories. Kate Payne, Iowa Public Radio reporter. Have a great weekend, Kate. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The Northern Lights, you rarely, if ever, see them from Iowa. I don't think I've ever seen them. But for millennia, humans in the higher latitudes have been enthralled by auroras, these sort of dancing ribbons of light above the Earth. And it turns out they still hold some secrets. In a new study, physicists led by the University of Iowa report a new feature to the Earth's atmospheric light show. Joining us to talk about it, Allison Janes, University of Iowa Assistant Professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy, and Riley Troyer, a PhD candidate in that same UI department. Riley and Allison, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks. Excited to be here.
Just to be clear, Allison, you are Riley's advisor. Before we get into the story of this new finding, Allison, remind us, what is the aurora?
So the aurora is basically the light emission that comes from particles dumping into our atmosphere. And you're right that you can usually only see them at very high latitudes. We also have a whole range of types of aurora. So the kind that you see on the picture on the wall is going to be a different source and a different mechanism from the type that, say, we're studying for this research here.
Okay, so let's go to the story of what was found. Take us back to the beginning. How did this start? And I don't know if that starts with you, Allison, or Riley.
Well, I'll start with that. So we have we had in our possession a video, some footage that was taken years ago as part of a field campaign. And they weren't really looking for this stuff. They were kind of looking for other things. But as it turns out, they captured observations of what Riley will describe in a minute. And it's just one of those things where we sat on this data for many years. And then once you start to look closely and have someone such as a student like Riley go in and do the careful analysis, it turns out that there's all kinds of new things to discover.
Mm-hmm. And Riley, what did you see that was new? When did it dawn on you? Was there a moment?
Yeah. So originally, to be honest, I kind of just took up the project because I wanted something nice and easy to get my feet wet in research as a new graduate student. But when I started to actually try and do some background reading and read up on this type of aurora that Allison had tasked me with studying, and I started to come up with empty-handed, really couldn't find anything on it, I started to realize that maybe this was something that hadn't been reported on before.
Mm-hmm. And what do you actually see? I've seen the video on the University of Iowa website, but describe it to us. It's subtle, isn't it? You have to know what you're looking for.
Yeah. So what one of these events looks like, it starts as this backdrop of very dim, homogeneous light that we call diffuse aurora. It doesn't change much. And then suddenly on top of that, almost like a second layer, you get this brighter stripe of light, of aurora, that appears. And then that stays around for a few seconds and then suddenly disappears. And what's really fascinating is that when it disappears, that backdrop of more dim diffuse light is darker, but only in the area where that brighter stripe was, almost as if someone has erased it. And then over the next half a minute or so, that backdrop light slowly colors in until it recovers to its original brightness.
I think the term you're using for us is diffuse auroral erasers. Allison, do we know why this happens or the significance of it?
We don't quite know that yet. So this is, like Riley said, the first reported observation of this particular type of eraser phenomenon. We think that it's been seen before because it didn't happen under unusual circumstances. But it's sort of one of those things where if we don't have the observations, we don't know how often it occurs. And one of the things we're trying to do with this is get some of the citizen scientists that are up at those higher latitudes to start recording, maybe finding some other cases when this type of aurora occurs. And that would be great for our science.
Mm-hmm. So recording it with special equipment, or could you possibly do this with a cell phone?
That's a good question. It depends on how dim it is. But with the cameras these days, amateur aurora watchers are getting fantastic videos that are actually helping scientists discover new things. So I think it's possible.
Mm-hmm. So what are the questions this finding raises, you think?
Well, one of the questions is what exactly is causing it? Because when you look at the aurora, you're really seeing the projection of things that are happening higher up or even further out in space. And so when we're seeing this phenomenon, we're trying to draw conclusions about what's happening in the space surrounding Earth. And right now, these are just theories because we don't have all the data in hand to be able to test them. But we're thinking that we're understanding more about what's happening out at that source region. So it's kind of nice, like looking at a TV camera and being able to make some conclusions.
Mm-hmm. Allison, I assume you've seen the aurora. What's the best viewing you've ever had, a memorable one?
Oh, boy. Probably the most memorable up in Kaktovik, Alaska. So that's up on the North Slope in a little village up there where I've been for a field campaign for a sounding rocket mission. And it's just fantastic because you're right underneath the lights and they look like they're coming down right on top of your head instead of way off in the distance. And it can be a magical experience.
Mm-hmm. Riley, have you experienced them yet?
I have, yes. So I actually was born and raised in Fairbanks, Alaska, which is right under that auroral oval. So I got to see them every winter growing up. But, you know, even still, even though I've seen them, you know, hundreds of times, it's still a really enthralling experience to see a really strong display.
Mm, and that's interesting, Riley. So seeing an aurora is something that takes you home, is sort of comforting, I would imagine.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that kind of drew me to researching the aurora is that, you know, I've since moved away from Alaska, but being able to study that kind of keeps my ties to where I'm from, mm-hmm. Which is nice.
Yeah. Allison, what does this mean for Riley's career as a physicist, this work he's done with you? I just don't know. Do PhD candidates often make these type of discoveries?
Well, it's just great, honestly. Riley is currently working on a lot of different research avenues funded by NASA. And something like this is, of course, incredible for his career. And I'm really proud of what he discovered here.
Riley, in closing, what are your goals as a physicist? What part of this field most interests you?
I'm really interested in the connections between the aurora and what we call space weather and society as a whole. So one, communicating it and just making people interested in the area, but also the effects it can have on things like communications, GPS, astronaut health, the electric grid, those sort of things.
Such fascinating research. Thank you for sharing it with us. Riley Troyer, PhD candidate in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Iowa. Allison Janes, assistant professor in that same department, talking about, a new study that describes a never before reported behavior, which they call diffuse auroral erasers, never before mentioned in scientific literature. The findings appear in the Journal of Geophysical Research Space Physics. Riley, Allison, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just added that to my bucket list. See the Aurora Borealis. Very interesting. Mark Simmet is with us. I don't know, Mark, have you seen an aurora? Have you gone to those northern latitudes? You have.
Actually, not as far north as Alaska, but I have seen the aurora in Duluth, the Duluth area.
Very good, enough
north that you can see it.
Very good. All right. Well, what do you have to groove us into the weekend? Mark Simmet of IPR's Studio One. What did you pick out for us?
Well, this time out, Ben, it's one of those 50th anniversary reissues that are popping up now and again. As time just marches on, it's been 50 years since the Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young album Deja Vu came out. Actually, 51 years.
Say it ain't so. All right.
it's a tough one. But back in March of 1970, this album was originally released, and today it's out in a new edition, a couple of different configurations, the original album remastered, of course, and there's a version where you can get 38 bonus tracks included along with it, demos, alternate versions, and some songs that just were not included on the original album in any form. Here's a demo.
If I had ever been here before, I would probably know just what to do. Don't you? If I had ever been here before on another time around the wheel, I would probably know just how to deal with all of you. And I feel like I've been. What's going on?
Wonderful, you picked out there, Mark. So again, these are recordings from 1970.
That's correct. In this case, we just heard a very early version of Deja Vu, David Crosby's song, with Graham Nash joining him on the harmony vocal on that one. So yes, actually, Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young only together for about a year, from mid-1969 to mid-1970, when the animosity between them caused them to break up. They got back together again occasionally in the 70s and much later on. But this album having a real impact, coming right after Woodstock, the Woodstock Festival, came out a month before the Beatles broke up. And some people say, this was kind of like a new generation's Beatles for the 1970s, even though, they weren't together that long. Their solo projects and Crosby, Stills and Nash and Crosby and Nash, various combinations continued for the decade.
Okay, send us out with one more if you could, Mark.
This is a Stephen Stills song that was totally ignored for that original Deja Vu album and unreleased, I believe, until now. It's called Ivory Tower.
So close, then again so far away. Where are the answers? I hear them every day. Loving at a distance, don't make it anyway. I can't reach her.
Fine tune, Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young, Ivory Tower. Mark Simmet, thank you for taking us down memory lane. A little bit of music history today in our Groove Into the Weekend. Listen to Mark, as well as his colleagues, C.C. Mitchell and Tony Daner, our RPR Studio One team, Monday through Friday, 7 p.m., Saturdays at 2 p.m., and 7 p.m., Sundays at 8 p.m., IPR Studio One. A great way to spend your weekend or your weekdays. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you, Ben. And I want to direct people to iowapublicradio.org. I've got a post there with more of these bonus tracks and more information about the album.
Very good. Thanks, Mark.
My pleasure.
River to River, produced today by Matt Alvarez. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a wonderful weekend.
She doesn't know.
Brilliant novels, groundbreaking nonfiction, evocative poetry, great books, and insightful conversations whenever you want them on the Talk of Iowa Book Club podcast. Pick the books that speak to you or read them all. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.